From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, this is Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Gina Cervetti. Each week, we bring you the best of Boston University from the worlds of scholarship, letters, politics, and the arts. Tonight, a birthday celebration and tribute to the life and legacy of civil rights leader, the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr.
King is, of course, legendary for his unflagging commitment to nonviolence in his passionate leadership of the civil rights movement in our country. That role was actually anticipated by none other than Mahatma Gandhi. Gandhi speculated it could be through the Afro-American that the unadulterated message of nonviolence would be delivered to all men everywhere.
Celebrating Martin Luther King Jr. tonight on Boston University's World of Ideas. First, this news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Craig Windham. The Democratic presidential candidates are blitzing the state of New Hampshire in advance of Tuesday's primary. North Carolina Senator John Edwards told a rally today that the administration's tax cuts do not benefit average Americans.
We want to create wealth, but unlike Bush, who only wants to create wealth for those who already have it, we want to create financial security and wealth for those who desperately need it. That's what this is about.
Edwards is trying to parlay his surprising second-place finish in Iowa into a strong showing in New Hampshire. Reverend Al Sharpton is campaigning in South Carolina today, where there's a primary a week from Tuesday. NPR's Adam Hochberg reports from Columbia.
Sharpton attracted almost no support in the Iowa caucus and doesn't expect to do much better in New Hampshire. But he has high hopes for South Carolina, where African Americans may represent as many as half the voters in the Democratic primary. Speaking at a Columbia church, Sharpton said he's the candidate who best understands minority issues, and he brushed aside concerns that he's too inexperienced to be elected.
Lady asked me the other day, she said, Reverend Sharpton, I support you, but you never held office. I said, that don't mean I haven't done work. You got a lot of folk in office, they ain't never done nothing.
Sharpton was the only candidate in South Carolina this weekend. The rest won't be here until after Tuesday's New Hampshire primary. Adam Hochberg, NPR News, Columbia.
A large winter storm is affecting much of the eastern half of the nation, and one of the hardest-hit states so far has been North Carolina. For member station WFDD, Stephanie Martin reports.
The layer of snow and ice that accumulated on state roadways Sunday prompted the governor to declare a state of emergency. National Guard troops are now on standby. State Department of Transportation crews hit the roads early Sunday, trying to plow and salt. DOT engineer Lane Hall says despite these efforts, roads remain treacherous.
The salt is not as effective at 16, 18 degree temperatures as it would be at the freezing point, for instance. That is causing some of the salt to refreeze or some of the melted snow to refreeze, and we have to reapply the salt.
The state says there were close to 2,000 traffic accidents on North Carolina highways between midnight and 3 p.m. Sunday. Road conditions are expected to worsen as freezing rain falls on top of snow. For NPR News, I'm Stephanie Martin in Winston-Salem, North Carolina.
The outgoing head of the U.S. effort to find weapons of mass destruction in Iraq once predicted that his search would turn up stockpiles of the banned weapons, but now David Kaye tells NPR News he wonders how he could have been so wrong.
My summary view, based on what I've seen, is that we are very unlikely to find stockpiles, large stockpiles of weapons. I don't think they exist.
Kaye said the failure to find weapons of mass destruction in Iraq is not a political issue, but a matter of whether the intelligence community is able to collect valid information. This is NPR News from Washington. Six people, including a toddler, were killed when fire swept through a motel before dawn in Greenville, South Carolina today. Other people managed to jump from windows or climb down bedsheets to safety. The motel had no sprinkler system because it was built before such devices were required in local building codes in South Carolina. The UN Refugee Agency has repatriated a first group of Rwandan refugees from southwestern Uganda. The agency says this is only the first of what is expected to be a much wider effort to return thousands of Rwandan refugees back to the homes that they fled nearly a decade ago. Lisa Schlein has the story.
The UN Refugee Agency says the first repatriation of more than 200 refugees from Uganda went smoothly. Spokeswoman Jennifer Clark says she expects this will encourage many more of the 23,000 Rwandans remaining in Uganda to ask the agency for help in returning home.
There's actually been over 1,000 people who have already signed up from this group of 23,000, so it's actually larger than this first movement. And we are hoping that as the movements get underway and people start returning, more people will come forward and sign up to go back.
About 2 million Rwandans fled their country after the 1994 genocide. Now, the UN Refugee Agency reports about 60,000 Rwandans remain exiled in several African countries. For NPR News, I'm Lisa Schlein in Geneva.
At the Golden Globe Awards in Beverly Hills, actor Tim Robbins has won the honors for Best Supporting Role for playing an adult child abuse survivor suspected of murder in Mystic River. Renee Zellweger won the award for Best Supporting Actress for her role in the film Cold Mountain. I'm Craig Windham, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, sponsoring new small rigorous high schools around the country that prepare students for college, work, and citizenship. GatesFoundation.org.
Good evening and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Gina Cervetti. This past Monday, the nation celebrated the birthday of the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr., paying tribute to the life and legacy of the civil rights leader. At Boston University, where Dr. King received his Ph.D. from the School of Theology in 1953, students, faculty, and members of the community gathered to celebrate in song, with Dr. King's own words and with the words of those whose lives were changed by his work. The keynote speaker at the celebration was Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court Justice Roderick Ireland, the first African American to sit on that court. We'll hear from Justice Ireland later in the program, but we begin with opening remarks from Kenneth Elmore, Dean of Students at Boston University. Dean Elmore.
Today, I hope that you will clap very often. You'll hear songs. You'll hear Dr. King's voice, sometimes in readings of some of his works, and sometimes you'll actually hear it. I hope that you get moved a little bit, and if you get moved by the Spirit, clap or do whatever you got to do, but get moved. That's okay. If you get a new thought that comes with what happens here today as well, enjoy it. Take it in. Think about it. And take a bit of time to do what I'm going to do today, and that's to take a measure of what I've done, why I'm here, and what might be important. I say that because I'm a child of Brown versus the Board of Education. I am a product of the leadership of the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. And I know that for me to even stand here, I needed someone like that to come along to move me along as well. So if you can think about that in your life over the course of this program, we certainly appreciate it. To move our program along, to begin, I'm going to ask Ann Shea, our Vice President for Enrollment and Student Affairs, to deliver the official welcome on behalf of the university. Vice President Shea.
Thank you, Dean Elmore. I am pleased and deeply honored to welcome you to Boston University's celebration of the life of our alumnus, Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr. Martin Luther King, Jr. would have been 75 years old on January 15. The evidence of Dr. King's life and his work is in each of us here today. We are embraced each day by the legacy of his life, a life far too short, and certainly one of the most significant of the 20th century. Martin Luther King, Jr. was the pilgrim, the soldier, the most eloquent, and the most enduring voice of the civil rights movement, which transformed this nation. His assassination almost 36 years ago, well before any of our undergraduate students were born, was the second of three, with those of John and Robert Kennedy, that wrenched the nation in a span of 5 years. I was 17 years old when Dr. King was shot in Memphis, and a senior in high school. The junior high school to which I should have gone 5 years before in 1963 was legally integrated as a result of Brown versus Board of Education. But the governor's daughter was also to be enrolled there, and the school system made sure that the school was not available to Black and Chicano families. My parents refused to send me there, and enrolled me in a school outside of the district, and I remained there during high school. When I graduated, my best friend Gregory and I shared first place in our class, down to 4 decimal points. Greg went to Yale, was selected a Rhodes Scholar, graduated from the University of Texas Law School, and about 10 years ago gave up a successful practice to teach environmental law in the Northwest. I'm successful professionally and personally as well, but my success does not represent what my friend's does. Greg is black, and even 5 years before we entered high school, we would have been in different schools with different opportunities and almost surely different lives than those we have both led. This is what we're talking about here today and what we are celebrating. We must not lose sight of this legacy, and we must not take for granted what so many fought and some died for. We may all take pride in the fact that Boston University has, from its founding in 1839, welcomed students regardless of race, religion, gender, and ethnic heritage. We are proud that Martin Luther King Jr. was welcomed here in 1951 and found a mentor in Howard Thurman, the first black dean of a chapel at a predominantly white institution of higher learning. But we should all of us, be indignant. Boston University was only one of a very, very few schools at which we would have been allowed to study. Not Harvard, not Yale, not Chicago, and surely not the State University in his native Georgia. We are rightfully proud that our alumnus, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize in 1964. We are deeply saddened that in the last years before his death, as he increasingly sought to discuss issues of class and not only racial inequity, he was discouraged by some of his former supporters and targeted both personally and professionally by J. Edgar Hoover's FBI. Even as we as a nation have so much work still to do, I ask you to think today, as you listen to each voice in this program, whether speaking or raised in song or prayer, of how you embody Dr. King's dreams and how you can continue his work in your own way and extend the blessings of his life like the ever-expanding ripples from a single stone fallen into a pool to those who follow you. Join us now as we reflect on the legacy of a great man and the promise of our own lives. You are truly welcome here. Thank you.
Thank you, Vice President Che. As the provost of Boston University, Dennis Berkey is the university's chief academic officer. Provost Berkey is also a professor of mathematics in the College of Arts and Sciences. He will deliver the occasion for today's program. Please join me in welcoming Provost Dennis Berkey.
Thank you, Dean Elmore, and good afternoon, everyone. The Reverend Martin Luther King Jr., whose work and memory we honor today, was the father of the civil rights movement in this country, remembered especially for his philosophy of nonviolence, a son of Boston University, earning his PhD degree here in 1955, and a brother to the Reverend Howard Thurman, Dean of Marsh Chapel, beginning in 1953. King is, of course, legendary for his unflagging commitment to nonviolence in his passionate leadership of the civil rights movement in our country. As reported by Kathleen Kilgore in her History of Boston University, that role was actually anticipated by none other than Mahatma Gandhi. Howard Thurman and his wife had made a trip to India in 1936 and had met Gandhi. In their discussion of the history of blacks in America, Gandhi speculated to Thurman, and I quote, "It could be through the Afro-American that the unadulterated message of nonviolence would be delivered to all men everywhere." The thread of nonviolence running from Gandhi through Thurman to King knots tightly about Boston University. King, whose father was a respected Baptist minister in Alabama, had received a degree in theology from the Crozer Institute. He came to Boston University in 1951 to study philosophy, and to develop the intellectual framework that would ground the hard thinking and eloquent rhetoric of his life's work. In coming to our university, King joined an institution that had always been open to black students and faculty, where nearly half of all doctorates earned by black students in the United States in the field of religion and philosophy in that era were awarded, and where half a century earlier, Dr. Solomon Carter Fuller received a medical degree and became the nation's first black psychiatrist. While King and Thurman enjoyed a close friendship, it was King's teacher and mentor, Professor L. Harold DeWolf, and the philosophy of personalism, for which this university was known in that era, that enabled King to move from the religious fundamentalism of his youth to the more open, liberal, and practical philosophy for which he was to become famous. "I'm not concerned with the temperature of hell or the furnishings of heaven," he said, "but with the things men do here on earth." King completed the coursework for his doctorate in 1953 and took up a position as pastor of the Dexter Avenue Baptist Church in Montgomery, Alabama. He commuted between Boston University and Montgomery until his dissertation was completed in 1955. At about this time, a black woman named Rosa Parks refused to give up her seat on a bus in Montgomery to a white passenger, in defiance of what was then the law. She was arrested. Black leaders in Montgomery called for a boycott of the bus company and turned to King for leadership. He responded, as Kilgore writes, by putting the philosophy of personalism and the tactics of Gandhi into action, taking center stage in one of the great dramas of American history. Martin Luther King Jr. was assassinated in Memphis, Tennessee on April 4, 1968. It was an event every bit as tragic and frightening to those of us who remember it as today's acts of terrorism. It is altogether fitting, indeed essential, that Martin Luther King Jr. be remembered, understood, and celebrated on this campus, not only because he studied here, and his papers are proudly housed in our special collections and actively used by so many scholars, but because his work remains unfinished, compelling, and urgent. Our nation has never before enjoyed such levels of affluence, yet the world has never seen so many poor. Throwing open the doors of our colleges and universities has not solved the divide between privilege and poverty. The global village is not a global community. We are the world's sole superpower. Yet some form of violence, whether military, terrorist, or criminal, remains the story of the day. Martin Luther King Jr. understood and tried to explain, and I quote, "Through our scientific and technological genius, we have made this world a neighborhood, and yet we have not had the ethical commitment to make it a brotherhood. But somehow and in some way, we've got to do this. We must all learn to live together as brothers, or we will all perish together as fools. We are tied together in the single garment of destiny, caught in an inescapable network of mutuality. And whatever affects one directly affects all indirectly. For some strange reason, I can never be what I ought to be until you are what you ought to be. And you can never be what you ought to be until I am what I ought to be." May Martin Luther King Jr.'s words and the examples of his life continue to inspire us, and move us in the ways and in the direction in which he led. Thank you.
Thank you, Provost Berkey. Please join me now in welcoming another group of our students under the direction of Herbert Jones, the Inner Strength Gospel Choir.
Do you think, Dr. King, that keeping children out of school is a valid technique in the civil rights movement?
Now, if you mean a school boycott, I'm not for dropouts, and I urge I urge all Negroes to stay in school because I think it's most important. I understand many of the social problems that cause dropouts, but still, I think it's necessary for Negro leaders to urge Negroes to stay in school. However, I have endorsed the idea of the school boycott, if well planned and organized, in order to dramatize the problem of de facto segregation and dramatize the need for quality integrated education. I think they should be well planned. I don't advocate the undisciplined use of the school boycott method, but I do feel that if it's well planned, organized, and not overused and misused, it can serve the purpose of bringing to the attention of the total community the problem of de facto segregation in the schools.
To the Lord.
Again, thank you, Inner Strength. Many of you are aware that this marks the 50th anniversary of the Brown versus Board of Education decision. We want it this year, certainly on the 75th anniversary of Dr. King's birth, to look at the context of segregated education in the United States. And certainly if you've read anything recently, you will know that many people are concerned about a reentrenchment of segregation in our society, certainly in our educational institutions. We thought for our readings this year, instead of some of the more classic sorts of pieces that you may have heard from Dr. King, that we would try to look at his views on education. We have three of our students who will read pieces. One piece is from a published essay contest in which Dr. King won as a junior in high school in 1944. He talks about the Negro and the Constitution, and in that talks about democracy and education. You'll also hear from one of our students a piece that he wrote for the Maroon Tiger, a campus newspaper at Morehouse College, Dr. King's piece during his junior year of college, where he spoke about the purpose of education. And then finally, a piece in 1958 from his book, Stride Towards Freedom, Dr. King speaks about education and segregation as well. Our three readers will be Antipas Harris, who is in the School of Theology. He's the class of 2006. Sarita Mollett, who is in the Sargent College of Rehabilitative Sciences. She is part of the class of 2003 as well as the class of 2005. And Michael Pereira, who is a member of the class of 2005 in the School of Hospitality Administration. We'll begin with Mr. Harris.
Strive towards freedom. The schools of the South are the present storm center. Here, the forces that stand for the best in our national life have been tragically ineffectual. A year after the Supreme Court had declared school segregation unconstitutional, it handed down the decree outlining the details by which integration should proceed with all deliberate speed. While the court did not set a definite deadline for the termination of this process, it did set a time for the beginning. It was clear that the court had chosen this reasonable approach with the expectation that the forces of goodwill would immediately get to work and prepare the communities for a smooth and peaceful transition. But the forces of goodwill failed to come through. Other forces of justice failed to act. As a result of the failure of the moral forces of the nation to mobilize behind the school integration, the forces of defeat were given the chance to organize and crystallize their opposition. While the good people stood silently and complacently by, the misguided people acted. If every church and synagogue had developed an action program, if every civic and social welfare organization, every labor union and educational institution had worked out concrete plans for implementing their righteous resolutions, if the press, radio, and television had turned their powerful instruments in the direction of educating and elevating the people on this issue, if the President and Congress had taken a forthright stand, if these things had happened, federal troops might not have had been forced to walk in the corridors of Central High School. But it is still not too late to act. Every crisis has both its dangers and opportunities. This crisis has the potential for democracy's fulfillment or fascism's triumph, for social progress or retrogression. We can choose either to walk the high road of human brotherhood or to tread the low road of man's inhumanity to man.
From the Negro and the Constitution. Black America still wears chains. The finest Negro is at the mercy of the meanest white man. Even winners of our highest honors face the class color bar. Look at a few of the paradoxes that mark daily life in America. We cannot have an enlightened democracy with one great group living in ignorance. We cannot have a healthy nation with one-tenth of the people ill-nourished, sick, harboring disease, which recognizes no color lines, obeys no Jim Crow laws. We cannot have a nation orderly and sound with one group down and thwarted that is almost forced into unsocial attitudes and crime. We cannot come to full prosperity with one great group so ill-delayed that it cannot buy goods. So, as we gird ourselves to defend democracy from foreign attack, let us see to it that increasingly, at home, we give fair play and free opportunity to all people.
From the purpose of education, I too often find that most college men have a misconception of the purpose of education. Most of the brethren think that they should equip that education should equip them with the proper instruments of exploitation so that they can forever trample over the masses. Education must train one for quick, resolute, and effective thinking. To think incisively and to think for oneself is often very difficult. We are prone to let our mental life become invaded by the legions of half-truths, prejudices, and propaganda. At this point, I often wonder whether or not education is fulfilling its purpose. A great majority of the so-called educated people do not think logically nor scientifically. Even the press, the classroom, the platform, and the pulpit, in many instances, do not give us the objective and unbiased truths. To save man from the morass of propaganda, in my opinion, is one of the chief aims of education. Education must enable one to sift and weigh evidence, to discern the true from the false, the real from the unreal, and the facts from the fiction. The function of education, therefore, is to teach one to think intensively and to think critically. But education, which stops with efficiency, may prove to be the greatest menace to society. The most dangerous criminal may be the man gifted with reason, but with no morals. We must remember that intelligence is not enough. Intelligence plus character, that is the goal of education. The complete education gives one not only the power of concentration, but worthy objectives upon which to concentrate. The broad education will, therefore, transmit to one not only the accumulated knowledge of the race, but also the accumulated experience of social living. If we are not careful, our colleges will produce a group of closed-minded, unscientific, illogical propagandists consumed with immoral acts. Be careful, brethren. Be careful, teachers.
Thank you, Mr. Harris, Ms. Mollett, and Mr. Pereira. Ronald Cass is the dean of the Boston University School of Law and Melville Madison Bigelow Professor of Law. Dean Cass will introduce our guest speaker. Dean Cass?
The Supreme Judicial Court of Massachusetts is the highest court in the state and the oldest court to sit continuously in session in America. Our guest speaker today is the Justice Roderick Ireland, who is a justice of the Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court and the first African American to sit on that court. Justice Ireland has degrees from Lincoln University, from Columbia University School of Law, from Harvard Law School, a PhD from Northeastern, honorary degrees from numerous universities and colleges. He is truly overeducated for his job. Justice Ireland has sat as a judge for nearly 30 years now. He sat as a judge on the Boston Juvenile Court, as a justice on the Massachusetts Appeals Court, and since 1997 as a justice on the Supreme Judicial Court. He's also served as a teacher at Northeastern University, at Harvard University, and most important, at Boston University. He's been a lawyer for Neighborhood Legal Services in New York City and for the Roxbury Defenders Program in Boston. He's also held numerous administrative appointments as, among other things, as Assistant Secretary and Chief Legal Counsel for the Massachusetts Executive Office of Administration and Finance. Dr. King wished for a nation where men would be judged on the content of their character rather than the color of their skin. I'm delighted to introduce a man of great character, of integrity and honor, a voice for equality and justice under law. Please join me in welcoming the Honorable Roderick Ireland.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you, Dean Cass, for that very gracious introduction, and thank you, ladies and gentlemen, for your warm reception. Distinguished guests, ladies and gentlemen, and members of the Boston University family, it is indeed an honor to be the speaker for your 2004 King Day celebration, but it is also very daunting to stand before so many with the assignment of speaking about Dr. King, given the significance he has in our country's history and the significance of this occasion. Let me begin by stating the obvious. Dr. King was a giant. We all know of his dream for equality, his belief in social, economic, and political justice, and his commitment to nonviolence and peace. We also know that his religious faith was at the core of these principles, which shaped the legacy he left. These values shaped his spirit and produced an awesome man. Dr. King was a leader in the truest sense of the word. He looked beyond his own self-interest and overcame his fears to become the preeminent spokesman for freedom and justice in our country. As he once said, an individual has not started living until he can rise above the narrow confines of his individualistic concerns to the broader concerns of all humanity. And starting with himself, Dr. King called on all who would listen to do the same, to be part of what he called a revolution of values, which he deemed essential to achieving his dream of equality. William Cullen Bryant, the famous American poet, wrote the following: "Greatness lies not in being strong, but in the right use of strength. Strength is not rightly used when it serves only to carry a man above his followers for his own solitary glory. He is greatest whose strength carries up the most hearts by the attraction of his own." Dr. King's strength did indeed carry up hearts by the attraction of his own. And it is because of his greatness and the right use of that strength that we are attracted to him. Consider, if you will, two points. First, that Dr. King made his impact over a very short period, just 13 short years, from the beginning of the Montgomery bus boycott in 1955 to his death in 1968, at the tender age of 39. Second, that Dr. King had not been elected or appointed, but that he stepped up to the plate as an ordinary citizen to do something to right the social wrongs which he saw and could no longer tolerate. In a recent column appearing in the Providence Journal, Leslie Gutterman spoke of the power of one, the influence that one person can have if motivated by heartfelt conviction. And she quoted the 19th century poet Edward Everett Hale, who wrote this, "I am only one, but still I am one. I cannot do everything, but still I can do something. And though I cannot do everything, I will not refuse to do the something that I can do." The power of one, that is what resonates with me as I consider the life of Dr. King. The power of one, that is how Dr. King began the work which has made such a difference for us all today. The power of one, that is ultimately the force which lies within each of us here today. As individuals, we can't do everything, but as individuals, we still can do something. Now, ladies and gentlemen, each morning on my way to work, I drive the length of Blue Hill Avenue from Mattapan Square through Grove Hall into Roxbury to the outer fringes of Boston Medical Center. It is impossible not to see the vestiges of poverty that still exist 36 years after Dr. King's death, and equally impossible not to contemplate their continuing impact on the daily lives of so many people. And whether we look at global and international issues such as terrorism, or the problems in the Middle East, or the problems in Africa, or Iran, or Iraq, or Ireland, or we look closer to home to issues such as illiteracy, or homelessness, or teenage pregnancy, or drugs, or unemployment, or crime, one thing is common to each and every issue, and that is there are people in great need, people who struggle mightily just to make it from day to day. While significant gains have been made, much remains to be done, for we are far from achieving the equality that Dr. King would have wanted or expected. Let us take a look at education, for example, a fitting topic, I would think, as we convene in the heart of this great institution of higher education, which counts Dr. King as one of its own. Consider an age where computers take precedence over interpersonal relations, where standards, expectations, and achievement reflect the disparity among neighborhoods, and where violence in school is experienced by children of all ages. You may ask yourselves, what difference can one person make in the face of such epic trouble? But please also contemplate the elementary school teacher who made you struggle with multiplication tables, the high school guidance counselor who challenged you to volunteer, your coach who explained that strength was only a product of the heart you brought to the sport, or your professors who charge you to put into effect the theories you learned in class in your real-world activities. With these memories, we are motivated to do, to achieve, and to accomplish, and that is what Dr. King would have wanted. But it's not just in the field of education where we can put Dr. King's values into practice. I believe that Dr. King would encourage us in our day-to-day dealings with each other to try to be more user-friendly, to try to be better neighbors and better co-workers, better fathers and mothers, husbands and wives, brothers and sisters, and better sons and daughters. He would urge us to remember that our own families and friends deserve at least the same respect and consideration that we so often give to strangers. Dr. King would probably remind us that we're all in the same boat, regardless of who we are or what we do. So I know that he would urge us today to give a hand not only to each other, but also to the little guy, to the man and woman that Dr. King referred to as the man farthest down. He would urge us to reach out and to reach back to give a hand to those less fortunate than ourselves. And I am sure that Dr. King would point out that none of us got to where we are all by ourselves. And he would challenge us to consider where we would be if someone had not reached out to help us. If he were with us today, Dr. King would surely refer us to the Bible. And one passage that comes to mind is from the book of Jeremiah, chapter 18. And it is the story about the potter who was working with clay on his wheel, and he made a mistake. The Bible says this: "Then I went down to the potter's house, and behold, he wrought a work on the wheels. And the vessel that he made of clay was marred in the hands of the potter. So he made it again, another vessel, as seemed good to the potter to make it." And the verses go on to tell us that the Lord then said, "Behold, as the clay is in the potter's hand, so are ye in my hand." The point of the verses is that the potter didn't give up and throw the clay away. He continued to work with it until it took shape and form. And Dr. King would have reminded us how, in the same way that God works with us, he also looks to us to work with each other to create a more just, fair, accepting, and loving world that focuses not on our differences, but on the common humanity that we all share. So, ladies and gentlemen, as we pay tribute to the memory of Dr. King, let us renew our sense of commitment to social justice. In all our actions and interactions with each other, let us strive to be voices rather than echoes, headlights rather than taillights, players rather than spectators. We must be voices for our community and advocates for people of all races and creeds. And let us be reminded, too, of the power of one, that each of us has the power to change a life, to redirect those who are off track, and to encourage and support the efforts of others to improve their situation in whatever way we can. On this symbolic occasion, let us reaffirm our commitment to the principles for which Dr. King lived and died. And then let us do what we can. It really doesn't matter what, so long as we do something. May the memory of Dr. King inspire you as you leave here today, and may God's peace and love be with you always. The struggle continues. Thank you.
Thank you, Justice Ireland.
Who were the people and what were the events during your student days here at Boston University which helped to shape your philosophy and to spur you to leadership action?
Well, I did a great deal of my work, I would say most of my work, under Dr. L. Harold DeWolf, who is a very dear friend of mine even to this day. And, of course, I was greatly influenced by his basic theological and philosophical position, and greatly influenced by Dr. Brightman. I had the privilege of studying with him before he passed on. And the whole doctrine of personal idealism, philosophically is the philosophical position that guides my theology. I also had the privilege of meeting some professors here who were engaged in social action, like Dr. Alan Knight Chalmers. He had worked with the NAACP for a number of years and had been very active in it. And my association with men like that also caused me to deepen my concern. And, of course, many of the studies that I continued to make concerning the philosophy and theory of nonviolence naturally influenced my thinking. And when I went to pastor in Montgomery, Alabama, all of these things came back to me as we started out in the movement there.
I'm now pleased to introduce Aaron Thomas Green of the Boston University College of Communication, class of 2005. Mr. Green is chairman of the Multicultural Affairs Committee of the Student Union Senate. You also saw him as he led the Interstate Gospel Choir. Mr. Green will deliver closing remarks on behalf of the students of Boston University and the Boston University Student Union. Mr. Green?
First of all, I would like to say that I am honored to be here. I am honored because on this day I have been afforded the opportunity to honor a man who has influenced my life in ways so great they are difficult to explain. But rather than speak about my personal King experience, I want to speak directly to a specific group of people, the undergraduate student body. The title of my closing remarks is From Rhetoric to Reality, Actualizing the Dream. However, in keeping with my desire to appeal to undergrads, I have chosen the subtitle, Don't Sleep on the Dream. So often, we the children of the mid-80s are at a loss when it comes to understanding Martin Luther King. Our births are far removed from King Day becoming King Day. Farther still are they from his life and assassination. As a result, we fail to appreciate just who Martin Luther King was and what his life and subsequent death meant, not only for African Americans then, but for all people then and now. We are not the grandchildren of slaves, nor are we the direct children of sharecroppers. We are not the direct victims of the Jim Crow experience and have therefore placed it and much of the civil rights movement in our imaginations. The danger of this action is the birth of an apathetic attitude toward a man and legacy that have influenced the world in ways larger than time permits me to describe. We have heard his I Have a Dream speech, and many of us have had to memorize at least one portion of it. We have had to learn about him, and all too often only him, during Black History Month, year in and year out. And what do we have to show for it but an active imagination? We make Dr. King's dream no more than a part of history. We reduce a Nobel Prize-winning, world-influencing, and life-changing man to a soundbite, I Have a Dream. Dr. King's dream holds little water in our minds and hearts. We dream his dream, however, not in the sense that we actively desire it to become reality. In fact, we have become complacent with it being empty rhetoric. But there is hope. If I may use a phrase written by the Apostle Paul, now it is high time for us to awake out of sleep. No longer can we allow King's dream to remain dormant in history books and documentaries. We must become not only hearers and imaginers, but also doers. Let us not allow Dr. King's life and death to be in vain by minimizing their discussion to one day out of the year. Had Dr. King wanted no more than a holiday, his assassination would never have taken place. But he did want more, and so should we. And now we must pick up the torch rather than just watch the reruns of it being run decades ago. Dr. King told us in a speech shortly before his assassination that he had been to the mountaintop and had seen the promised land, and that although he may not get there with us, that we as a people would get there. Well, my friends, I'm here to tell you that we as a people have yet to get there. Just look around today. Many of our classmates have chosen to honor this day not by remembering King's dream, but rather by sleeping in or taking a trip to enjoy a long weekend. Those of us who have a desire, who have a yearning, must pass on the word. We must initiate and engage in conversation. We must never stop at believing that we have come far enough. We must encourage one another to never cease to remember that dreams without plans are no more than pictures. And although pictures are worth 1,000 words, actions speak volumes louder. Therefore, let us not stop at today and wait until next year before we take action. Keep Dr. King's dream alive by living it each day of your life in words, but more importantly, in deeds. Let us be transformed nonconformists. Let us not allow our education to blind us from the injustices that still permeate our everyday society, now on a global level. Let us not be complacent with gray areas replacing racial lines while equality is still far from sight. And most importantly, let us not make his death in vain. My friends and classmates and all of those under the sound of my voice, don't sleep on the dream.
Thank you, Mr. Green. That concludes our program. Thank you for coming.
Kenneth Elmore, Dean of Students at Boston University, closing out last Monday's birthday celebration and tribute to the life and legacy of civil rights leader, the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr. For a CD or cassette of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. That's 1-800-909-9287. CDs and cassettes are $15 and includes shipping and handling. Tonight's program was produced by Matt Largy and Tim Skog, with help from Boris Strapotsky. Our web producer is Angel Cazelli. I'm Gina Cervetti. Thanks for joining us.